Hey everyone, great show in store for you this week. We sat down with new Brooklyn Nets general manager Sean Marks and NBA Deputy Commissioner Mark Tatum. Stay with us.
Yahoo Sports presents the Vertical Podcast with Woj, taking you inside the game. Powered by digital media, find your voice. And now, your host, Adrian Wojnarowski.
Hey everyone, welcome into another edition of the Vertical Podcast with Woj. This is Adrian Wojnarowski here at Barclays Center with the new general manager of the Brooklyn Nets, Sean Marks. Sean, thanks for taking time to join us on the Vertical Podcast. I know you're going a mile a minute here since arriving into Brooklyn late last week. Have you figured out how to get around yet? Is that, or are you just relying on car service?
I'm relying on a car service, but figuring out how to get around, that could take me a while. It's probably the least of my concerns right now.
Sean, this happened relatively fast. It was, the Nets went through a process, but your decision-making process on taking a job had to go pretty quickly. What I was told was after you interviewed with the Nets that they really started to recruit the Spurs, R.C. Buford, Greg Popovich, really started to recruit them to, A, help give their blessing and then also convince you to do this, that you really sold them in that presentation interview process. You had never interviewed for a job like this before. What happened in there that you felt like you struck a chord with their people?
No, you know, it's funny you say it because like most people, I assume, you leave an interview and you go, God, I'm not going to get it. I didn't do a good enough job, right? I didn't say what I wanted to say. I didn't get my vision across or whatever it could have been. So I obviously leaned on RC and Pop, you know, before the interview process, during it, and during the whole process of this. And RC was honest and said to me, look, Sean, I've never got a job that I interviewed for, so don't ask me. I'm the worst person for it. But, you know, he said that a little bit in jest. And I came away from the interview with them having heard, you know, look, Brooklyn's a challenge, there's a long way to go and so forth, and which there is, you know. I'm always up for a challenge and I enjoyed that. But what stuck out to me was when, you know, ownership sat there and said, look, we're committed to turning this around. We're committed to winning. We're going to make these changes and so forth. And you know, we want this person, the GM, to lead that ship. And that's all I needed to hear.
Spending the time you spent in San Antonio and spending time around the league and other places, mm-hmm. as a player, everybody talks about commitment, but mm-hmm. when you're around the league, you understand where it's real and where it's just talk. And obviously in San Antonio, it permeates from top to bottom. Peter Holt, the San Antonio owner, has, you know, he lives in San Antonio, a very close partnership with Pop and RC, and great trust in them. Mm-hmm. I know there are times where Peter maybe hasn't agreed or thought maybe that was the right avenue, but he trusted that RC and Pop had given it great little thought and allowed them to make decisions. When you have an owner in Mikhail Prokhorov who lives in Moscow, who may not be as connected day to day, there are intermediaries between you and him. Was that a concern of yours? Is it a concern of yours? Or was that satisfied that there'll be the right kind of communication for you to – you've got to sell up mm-hmm. sometimes. You've got to mm-hmm. sell vision upwards, not just downwards.
Sure. Well, as was reported, I hadn't met Michael for quite some time. I didn't meet him in the interview. Obviously, I'm kidding there. But I would hope that I can bring him in. You know, I want ownership involved, but I also want him to be able to trust myself and the staff that are going to be here in making those right decisions. And I realize that trust is earned and so forth, but it was important for me to discuss with him the collaboration and the partnership that was going to be needed, not only between he and I, but it's myself and whomever the next coach is and so forth, and the various different areas around, whether it's the performance team, the coaching staff. We all need to be in this together. It's a collaboration. It's together. That's what I learned in San Antonio. Yes, there's RC and Pop that make those decisions, but again, one of the greatest things about, you know, being in a coach's meeting in San Antonio or a front office meeting with RC was their willingness to accept others' opinions. And, you know, hey, maybe it wasn't a great time, but you never know when somebody's going to come up with, hey, look, that's a great thought. We hadn't thought of it from that way, and run with it.
I've been told, it's interesting you bring that up, Sean, because people who've worked in San Antonio, guys who worked as interns and moved on to other places have told me that you can be an intern in a meeting, and now you better not just throw stuff out there, but if you have something to offer, Pop's going to listen to it, and that crosses. A coach could be in a front office meeting and offer something up, somebody in the front office can offer to coach, and it's not seen as you're intruding on somebody's territory. That is hard to create, though, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. No, that doesn't happen overnight. But as I sort of mentioned in my press conference before, was the people that we bring in here, I have to be open-minded in that regard. You know, I hope to bring in a staff, not only the front office staff, but the coaching staff that are all on the same page together. This is an exciting opportunity. We're starting from ground zero, you know.
And maybe even a little lower without picks, right? Maybe even a little lower than zero.
Let's not bring all that up. But, you know, we get to build something, and the people that are brought in, they're going to be the ones that are driving that culture. They're going to be the ones that are, taking ownership in it, and that's important.
Sean, when you finished, and I think it's an interesting stat on your career, R.C. Buford had brought it up with me previously, that for a player who spent 10 years in the league, you played fewer minutes than any player in NBA history, mm-hmm. and there's no close second. But what that taught him, though, was that people wanted to have you around, mm-hmm. that having you around their organization had a benefit, even if you weren't on the floor. Where does that come from with you? Where does that ability to connect with people and, again, make people want to have you around?
Well, firstly, you got to find out who is second because I want to hire him. No, on a serious note, look, everybody has their role. Everybody has a little niche, and I knew what my role was. I could have gone to Europe on several different occasions and made a lot more money than sitting here on the minimum in the NBA, but it came to a point where I said, look, I really like this. I'm part of something special, whether it was Miami, San Antonio, Phoenix, New Orleans, wherever it was. You know, I guess one of my attributes would be that I am a people person. I want communication. I want to, I don't think you have to get along all the time. I don't mind disagreement. And I really learned that from dealing with RC and Pop. It's like if everybody's a yes man, that doesn't work either. But I think you got to figure out your staff and what makes them tick. You got to know how many kids they have. You got to know what they like to do for a living. And that was a great attribute I've learned on several teams. You know, several teams that do it well. Miami did that well too. You know, Coach Riley, when I was there, went out of his way to know, my kids' names and what they were doing and interests and so forth off the court. And that goes a long way with establishing those relationships. So that's obviously helped me through my career, just wanting to get in and know what made Tim Duncan click or tick and get to know Steve Nash. And, I've got to play with some of the greatest players, ever. Shaquille and so the list goes on. But I hope to take a little bit away from all those guys and bring it to what I've learned and bring it here.
And that impressed people, too, that not only did you have relationships with the guys who were on the end of the bench, the other role players, but wherever you were, you built pretty good relationships with the star players, whether it was Steve Nash, in San Antonio, Manu, Tim. Yeah. I know the Spurs felt you were a great help in helping to recruit David West to the Spurs this summer when David had, you had played with him in New Orleans. What did you grow as a player to understand about the great player that helps you in this job?
You know what's funny?
And what you want out of a great player.
Yeah. You know what's funny is I think a lot of times the great players, the superstars, they just want to be treated like everybody else. They want to be included in those, hey, we're going to the movies tonight. We're going to dinner. You want to come? And instead of sitting in their room and thinking, well, we can't bother Tim with this. He's not going to work up. No, let's bring him. We're all here in this together. And I think they sort of felt a little bit, hey, look, this is great. I get to go hang out with my guys. And that's what it's all about, whether it's three guys, four guys, five guys, 10 guys. You want those guys together in an environment that's not always basketball. They see each other basketball all the time. And to be able to do it outside of basketball, to be able to on a casual lunch, a casual dinner, where they're not talking hoops. They're talking about, hey, Manu, what do you do in your spare time? They're finding little things out about each other. And that's where true friendships and true relationships and trust is formed.
Sean, when your career ended, when you were done playing, I know you had an offer. I think it was NBA London had a job offer for you. And you had a lucrative offer in San Antonio of exactly $0 and 0 cents, right, to be an intern.
Yeah.
What drew you to want to? Because you looked at other things too, finance, real estate,
sure.
right?
Yeah.
What
yeah.
drew you to say, I'm going to go just do it for free? And was it to find out if you wanted to get into that front office life or to learn from them? Or were you sure you wanted to do it and this is the place in San Antonio that you, if you have an opportunity, you got to take it?
Well, yeah, a couple of things. I think back from the days when I played in San Antonio as a player, I talked to Pop and RC about, you know, when it's all said and done, you know, coming back and being a part of a front office. And so we stayed in touch, you know, as 5-6 years went on and so forth. I did not want to be, and I didn't have the luxury of being one of those guys who said, look, I'm gonna stop playing now and I'm gonna go travel the world for 3 years and then I'll get back into it. You know, I realized, like, look, I just finished. I can still play. I've got something to offer. I can get back and do, and I did player development in San Antonio with Chip and Chad and the coaching staff, but also working, you know, half the day with RC on the front office side of things. So that was great. So I was really getting, thrown a lot on my plate and really getting exposed to a lot of things.
In 2000, you were in the front office that first year doing a little bit of everything to then running the D-League team in Austin. And then Mike Budenholzer and Brett Brown left for head coaching jobs, and Pop was without two of his, not only his elite assistants in the league, but two of his best friends, yeah. Right? And two of his close friends. And it was late in the summer, I think, when Brett left, yeah, right? Yeah. And they said, hey, Sean, we'd like you to come coach for a year.
Yeah.
And we want someone we're familiar with and you can do. And I think Greg Popovich had worked in the front office. RC Buford has been a coach. Yeah. And I think they felt that for your broader development in San Antonio, the plan was you'd always go back to the front office, but that you were going to learn by being a coach and that was going to help you as an executive. Yeah. How did it?
I can't even tell you how much that helped. That was just incredibly, really kind of Pop to do that, first of all. And I mean, what an amazing opportunity it is to sit on the bench with him. And the way he phrased it to me was, look, you're familiar with how I coach, what I do. I want you to come here and learn about how I value players, how I value talent, how I, you know, look at guys around the league and also the stress levels that my staff goes through. So he said, you know, when you become a GM one day, you'll have an appreciation for your staff, your coaching staff that you put around. And he couldn't have been more true. It's unbelievable because it's really important. As I've said before, the front office and the coach are in alignment. I have a partnership going, a vision going forward to this. And it was really evident, you know, to me when I was on the coaching staff that just how much, you know, Pop relied on RC, RC relied on Pop and so forth. And they were in this thing together. And it's true. I mean, it gave me a new appreciation for what coaches go through, you know, from the daily. I mean, it is a grind every single day, you know, the entire season. You know, front office has their moments throughout the season where stress levels are obviously higher than others. But it was great to see both Pop and RC on the same page there.
Sean, you grew up in New Zealand, spent some time in Fiji as a kid too, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of beach time, boats. I read you had said at one point, I mean, you could walk the beach for a mile and not see another person. There was a tranquility to that, right? And I know you had, like, your dad had a little one-man boat that you would just float around.
Yeah.
Almost like living in Brooklyn in one of the five boroughs. But what was that childhood like there? What was it like growing up like that?
You know, it was great. I mean, I obviously love New Zealand. I mean, New Zealand, you know, I often slip up and still call it home. I mean, it's obviously not anymore. The States is home. I've been here for 23 years. You know, my beautiful wife and kids, they're American. I mean, we go back to New Zealand every 3 or 4 years. But the upbringing there was special. I mean, it was a close-knit community. I think that taught me a lot about sort of morals and, you know, finding some good things in life and having the right perspective, so to speak. So, you know, I love it, but it is vastly different there than Brooklyn. But I've had the opportunity to live in some big cities along the way as well. So it's not going to be too crazy, I think.
And Sean, very similar to Manu Ginobili and other players who grew up in Europe, Manu in Argentina, you in New Zealand, who would watch those, David Stern, and look back, it was extremely forward-thinking. He would just give these half-hour NBA highlight shows for free. Give them to television stations and networks all over the world. And it's amazing how many of your peers of your age who were indoctrinated in the NBA by one half-hour highlights video. That's how you started when was it on?
It was on Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. I'll never forget because I used to battle between that and English Premier League soccer. So it was like, you know, we'd be fighting amongst, you know, whether it was my brother or whoever, what are we going to watch? But it quickly became, you know, the NBA, and I loved it. I fell in love with the showmanship, the athleticism of the guys there, and that's really when I started playing basketball and said, look, that's all I want to do. And there was no, and I was 13 years old, probably something like that.
Were there ample opportunities to play basketball, or did you have to go look around for competition teams at that age?
Yeah, there was really, you'd only play for your high school and your club team. There was no such thing as sort of the AAU, and you know, I was on every representative team that I could possibly find myself on, New Zealand under 16s, under 18s, under 20s, and so forth. And, you know, I'd want to practice with some of the pro divisions down there to get, you know, the better runs in, so to speak. But, I couldn't get enough of it. You know, it was, I fell in love. I mean, I was passionate about it and still am.
With your size and your athletic ability there, I would imagine rugby was, you must have taken some heat for not playing rugby. You were, it was like they made you in a test tube, right? Like you would have been a dominant player in that sport.
You know, I mean, like all, you know, Kiwi kids, you grow up and you're sort of given the rugby ball as soon as you step foot into the world. And you're indoctrinated into it. And I still follow rugby. I'm passionate about the All Blacks, and you know, we can get into that later. But their culture and their system is something that I'd love to try and implement too, and very similar to the one that I came from. But yeah, I definitely played rugby, but it didn't really have a spark for me. You know, it was always basketball.
What was Berkeley like as a kid who grew up in New Zealand? Berkeley's its own culture, it's its own.
Yeah.
Was that, looking back, the perfect place to grow, to learn about yourself for you?
Yeah. No, it really was, because I feel like at Berkeley I could be whoever I was going to be. Like I didn't have to become molded and go down certain avenues. You could do whatever you wanted to. I mean, it's such a diverse you know, campus. You know, they had the International House there. There was a ton of international students. They really catered to that. You know, I loved going to school there. I mean, the lecturers and the professors, you know, you'd be sitting there in front and you had no idea that your professor's got 20 books published or he's won a Nobel Peace Prize, whatever it may be. I mean, so we were very, very lucky to have those opportunities. So I loved being, and it suited me to a T.
And you redshirted a year, so you were there 5 years.
Yep.
You were in no rush to get out of there, right?
No, I really wasn't. I mean, I enjoyed it. I came there and I was young. So I came there, I was 17 when I first went to Cal. So I knew that, look, I was nowhere near developed and nowhere near ready to play. So it was a decision that I wanted to redshirt. They were happy with that. And, you know, I'm thankful that I did. Yeah.
When you walked into Berkeley as a freshman, did you think this is a stepping stone to the NBA, or you just thought, I'm just going to go play college ball? Did you think that was realistic?
I think I've always tried to have realistic expectations and goals. I like to set them pretty high. You know, you never know where you're going to land, so to speak. But I was just so happy to be at Berkeley and so happy to, hey, look, I've made my goal of getting a scholarship to a great university. I'm going to get a great education out of this, and we'll see what happens. As time went on at Cal, you know, I realized, okay, I've started to mature, started to develop into somewhat of a player, and said, okay, look, this is not unrealistic that I'm going to be able to make a living, you know, playing either in the NBA or abroad in Europe. And, you know, I had both those opportunities, so it's worked out great.
You met your wife, Jennifer, there, and she's lived this life. There's, you know, it's challenging to be, especially a role player, where you weren't going to stay anywhere too long. You have to keep packing up and moving, and I think you might have thought you would have been in San Antonio a while, and you would have been there as long as you wanted. And I know Pop and RC had big plans for you in the future. And one thing RC Buford said to me was, even if they couldn't bring you back to San Antonio, they would have brought your wife back to run the Wives Lounge, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's a partnership.
It is.
With this. Right?
No, I mean, no, she's amazing. I can't say enough about her. But it's, you know, she's learned from some of the best. I mean, we're fortunate. You know, I always look at it like, gosh, at the time, it's difficult to be a role player. You're packing up the family and a journeyman, and you're off to this place. You never know where you're going to be year in, year out. But everywhere we went, both, you know, Jennifer and myself, we got ingrained in that city, and we wanted to make the most of New Orleans, the most of Phoenix, and see what that city, the place, the people had to offer. And I think that was great, because it really it helped with our kids. I think our boys are, we have four boys, extremely well-rounded. I mean, they're used to living out of a suitcase for a little bit. And, you know, they've always been super supportive, and you're dead right. I mean, it is a partnership, and, you know, Jennifer and the boys, and as they grow older, they have a lot to say in where we live, what we do, and those sort of things. And, you know, it's great.
This is the Vertical Podcast with Woj.
Hey guys, Woj here. I want to tell you a little bit about Superbeats. February is National Heart Month. Cardiovascular issues affect the majority of both men and women in America. So we here at the Vertical Podcast encourage you to think about your heart health this month. I help to maintain my heart health by drinking Superbeats every day. It's a superfood powder that I mix with water or yogurt or put in a smoothie. The all-natural dietary nitrates and Superbeats are sourced from non-GMO beets, and they help boost my circulation and support my healthy blood pressure naturally. Listen, I need a lot of energy to do this job, just like you do with yours, but I've always resisted unnatural energy drinks or boosters. Superbeats has become a staple for me. It gets me through trade deadlines and free agency and late nights in the NBA playoffs. And unlike other stamina boosters, there's only 3 grams of sugar per serving. Plus, it tastes like berries. I feel the energy and stamina boost in about 20 minutes or so, which no other superfood formula guarantees. I truly want you to try this product for National Heart Month. And if you don't like the results, you don't pay. Guaranteed. Get a 30-day supply free with your first order. You'll also get nitric oxide indicator strips free to use before and after drinking Superbeats to see if it's working in your body. Plus, get the free book, Beat the Odds, and all of this comes to you with free shipping. So call 800-892-7289. That's 800-892-7289, or go to wojbeats.com. That's WOJBEETS.com.
You mentioned the time you spent in Miami and with Pat Riley. You know, if we look at the last 15 years of the league, you know, the two preeminent franchises have been the Spurs and the Heat consistently. Mm-hmm. Pat Riley and Greg Popovich are very different people, and they run their organizations in very different ways. But what are the common traits that you say you take away from both of them that where they did cross?
One thing that stands out would be the caring for players. I mean, it's one thing you always hear about in San Antonio is, you know, how much Pop has taken his time to get to know that guy and really cares about him. Coach Riley did, you know, I call him Coach because he was Coach when I was there, but he was exactly the same. You know, I mean, I could go to him with any problem. You know, he'd listen. And again, he both of them really took time to get to know you. And if there was, it was very clear with both Pop and Coach Riley was that the players are number one. Everything revolves around your 15 guys. So it's, you know, the business of basketball could not change the outcome on the game. You know, it was, we weren't going to do something detrimental to the players by having them do an appearance or having them do something else that would affect their ability to perform at the highest level on the court. So everything was done, whether it was, hey, look, we need an extra nanny for the child's room. You know, so-and-so's had a baby now, and now we're overwhelmed there. So little things, Coach Riley and Pop and RC, they've always taken care of. Players are number one. There is no question of that.
And that's something in your role now where the one thing that some with the Spurs said to me about you was, as great as your ability to connect with people and build relationships, and that separated you, you're also not afraid to hold people accountable, and yeah. You will hold people accountable. Yeah. And sometimes the guys who are able to build relationships don't want to be the bad guy.
Yeah.
But I would imagine around those two places you've learned there's going to be times you're going to tell the business side no, right?
Yeah, you've got to have that. There's a fine line there, but I'm certainly not afraid to hold people accountable, and they'll understand. I mean, I want, whether it's the business side, the basketball, whatever you name it, we all need to be, you know, competing for that same common good of, look, we're going to be judged on wins and losses at the end of the day. That's the bottom line. And if it's going to affect our players and it's going to affect their ability to play, then that's a problem for me. So the players will know that, the business side will know that, you name it. I mean, it'll be clear.
Sean, as you're building your staff out here, your front office, you're scouting those that will be around you day in and day out, and obviously a coaching staff, players more and more are attracted. Players are smart. They're more sophisticated about who are the good organizations, mm-hmm. and you see that in free agency, yep. that the days of just going to the big market, it doesn't work that way.
Sure.
Just because you're L.A. or New York or Chicago doesn't mean you just –
If you have space, you get the players. They want to win, and they have to know they have a chance to win with you. Your mindset with this thing now, I think initially in Brooklyn there was a feeling, we'll build an arena in Brooklyn, we'll have space, and we'll get superstars to come free agency. It did not happen. Is your sense that what will attract players is the competence that you sell winning, right? You sell that geography doesn't work anymore.
Well, you know, with social media and everything else now, it's such a small world, and guys can, you know, it doesn't matter where they are, they can connect with their millions of fans instantly. Sponsors, same sort of thing. I think it's going to be important here in Brooklyn that everybody knows, look, we're going to make the right steps, and ownership has started to do that for sure, in making those right steps in order to win. And players want to see, like, look, I want to go there because this is how they treat my wife. This is how they treat my family. This is how they treat my body. You know, I've got the best performance team here willing to sacrifice. You know, I've got whatever it may be. If they need an extra massage therapist, they've got the extra massage therapist. They've got the best food available. They've got the best food. You know, one thing I learned in San Antonio is we are going to sacrifice the game in potentially February or March, but for the longevity of having Tim, Manu, Tony, and the rest of the guys healthy come playoff time, it's the longevity of guys' careers, and I think they appreciate that. You know, they know, like, look, he's got my future in his hands. It doesn't mean I'm not just being a racehorse out there and win run race. It's the big picture view, which is important to these guys.
Sports science has been a big part of with the Spurs, of trying to get ahead of what the next thing is. And I know you guys spend time all around the world looking not just at how basketball teams or an NFL or baseball team, but how global teams handle athletes. And I think there's a sense that maybe in Europe or in some other places that there's more of a focus on preventative, of being preventative with players' body versus rehab here, where it's always reacting. Is that, you've spent a lot of time focused on that. Will that be a big part of what you have to, an infrastructure you have to build here?
Yeah, that'll be a very, very large priority. And thankfully, you know, again, we're in a diverse city that a lot of this is close to. And we're close to Europe. We're close to great analytics guys here at the schools that are the surrounding here. I will definitely make it a priority that the performance team is one somewhat similar to what we had in San Antonio. And we were lucky there. We had a diverse team. And we listened to the players. The players sort of led that. They said, look, I go home to my national team and I get this, that, and the other. And, you know, maybe it's, we need more hands on deck here. And so we listened to them and, you know, we brought in, extra staff, you know, and the players really started believing it. Obviously it had Pop and RC and myself and the rest of the staff really, really pushing it and behind it. But the players, you know, loved it. I mean, they bought in. They loved the sports science side of it. They loved having the PTs and so forth. And that's something definitely that I'd want to, you know, implement here.
Sean, with very limited draft picks, first or second round over the next several years, second round picks you can buy. You can go get them at times. Those are easier. There's a greater premium on first round picks around the league to get them back without giving up something significant. Will that force you to be far more creative in the next few years, whether that's maybe especially with your overseas scouting to find players? And we can go through the list, but will a lot of your focus be spent on maybe more unconventional player acquisition over the next few years to compensate?
Yeah, you know what? We're going to have to be open to everything. You know, we cannot sit here and say, no, we're not going to look here, we're not going to look there. One of the great things about what's happening here is the purchase of the D-League team. You know, so that's where we are going to be really strong and trying to develop, trying to find guys within our own system. Obviously, as you mentioned, the international scouting will be a big, big part of that. And there's a lot of different ways to skin a cat. Yeah, we don't have first round picks, and would I like them? Absolutely. But we can figure out, you know, we can be strategic in how we maybe get into the first round. Mm-hmm. If there's people available in there that we think we can go after and get, well, maybe we have some tools that can get us into there. Now, I'm not saying we're going to. But we have to be strategic and just be ready to pounce whenever we have to.
Eventually here, you're going to have to decide on a head coach. And I have to imagine when you've been around Pop there, you're, I guess, spoiled is the word, right? You say, I'm sure all the attributes you'd love to have in a coach are the ones that Pop has, but there is no other Greg Popovich. No. And people can only be themselves. What's important for you in a coach, and what's going to be important for you and a partnership, because you're going to need a coach who's going to have to see the long view with you and not chase the short-term wins. Yeah. That's, you've got to figure out a guy who you can work with here and go forward with. That's not easy. This is a challenging, because your priorities and his of wanting to win in the short term or be more competitive, you know, can be at odds at times.
Well, Pop turned me down already, so I'll be clear with that. You know, I think the best, or one of the, it's hard to say the best, but one of the best attributes that I've witnessed with Pop is he's a great, great communicator. I think he's magic with that. And the way he can connect with players is, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, players legitimately just love him. I mean, they go to him with everything. You know, he's the team psychologist, he's the team head coach, he, you name it, they'll go to him with, whether it's financial problems, family problems, you name it, they want to talk to him about it. They want his opinion. They, and what he has encouraged, not only the communication between staff and the players, but between each other too. I mean, he'll do some of the most unique little things, you know, pre-practice, where he'll get guys talking and out of their comfort zone a little bit, which is really unique. You know, he'll gather them all together and, you know, we'll talk about the game the night before or the game we're about to play that night, and he'll say, before we even start, you know, hey, Tim, did you pay taxes? Or did you vote this year? Not yet. Well, Tim, you think you should probably vote, right? You pay taxes here. Don't even have a say in who, where your taxes are going, so to speak. But they'll have this great little banter in front of the team, and it'll get the team talking, and he'll ask, hey, look, Thiago, for example, what happened, you know, back in Brazil? Tell us about that. And this communication that happens within the group is really, really special. And that would be obviously something I would look for, in a head coach. Somebody who's, has that caring, and the players know that. The great communication. You know, he's, you know, look how humble Pop is. You know, we leave every win humble and victory, guys. You know, get out there and, you know, have a sense of humor. These things are important. It's a long season. It's a long grind, and those things will be important.
And I think, too, with what makes it work and the core players there and the ownership they have of the team, of the locker room, like I always say, you never, in all the years, you've never heard a guy in San Antonio be upset about, hey, I'm not getting enough touches, I'm not getting enough shots. But that doesn't mean it didn't happen or it doesn't exist, but they always took care of it internally. And Tim, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. No. Those things never got out in the media. And like every team, there's always going to be people that are frustrated with, gosh, I wish I could have, you know, as you said, more touches, more shots, more court time, whatever it may be. But at the end of the day, that entire group, players, coaching staff, front office, we're all focused on, you know, a goal that's bigger than oneself. You know, it's not an individual goal. It's, you know, we can do something pretty special, but it's going to take the group of 15 to do it, you know, and that was the always underlying there. And of course, with your superstars, buy in and don't say anything. The rest of us certainly don't say anything.
Right. When you look at what it's, people always say, you know, they all want to recreate what's in San Antonio. And as you know, it will never be recreated. No. It can't be. Mm-hmm. The people, the players, the coaches, the executives, it's so unique. But when you look at around the league, though, Dennis Lindsay, who went to Utah, and Mike Budenholzer, who went to Atlanta, you can see pretty clearly how they built their rosters, the kind of guys they brought in, how they play, that is something of a blueprint of being influenced by San Antonio. Are those, when you look at those places and say, hey, that, you know, they certainly built with young players, they didn't take shortcuts, they kept flexibility, character guys. People want to know what Brooklyn might look like or what you want to try. Are those two teams who had Spurs executives, obviously Oklahoma City, with how they've done it with Sam Presti, should Nets fans look to those and say that might look a little like what we want to do?
Yeah, I mean, I would hope so. I mean, all the teams you mentioned, the guys you mentioned, have just done tremendous job of establishing, one, a vision, a culture. Obviously, you've got to be lucky sometimes getting the right players, so forth, to fit. But it goes with, you know, one of the big lessons I learned with Pop is never skipping steps. You know, it's, look, stay true. This is our culture. We're not going to wane from it. We're not going to take those gambles and risks on players that you go, gosh, he's not really our culture fit. That's not potentially what's best for our group. And you're right. I hope that, you know, in a year, 2-3 years' time, that it starts unfolding and the people, the fans in Brooklyn go, okay, look, you know, we've got a competitive group out on the floor. but it's going to be that same group that they see in the community that the community can be really proud of, you know, as people and as individuals.
I wonder if this was a question you asked, Sean, and when the Nets moved to Brooklyn, immediately it was, we're competing with the Knicks, we're competing with the Knicks. They tried to, you know, upstage them in different ways and certainly short-circuited. When you talk about skipping steps, they skipped steps. They went and are left in a situation they're left in now. Is that important to you that we're not competing with them? We're competing with the other 29 teams. Yeah. Is that how you view this thing?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I can't be as sort of shallow to think, hey, look, I'm just going to be competing with that one team. I mean, we're all against each other here. And you're right, there's 29 other teams
and
out there.
And part of that is chasing headlines, that you can't chase headlines.
No, we're not going to do that. We're going to stay true to who we are. And, you know, our vision will be pretty firmly set going into next year, where people realize, okay, this is the caliber of players they want to try and get. This is the coaching staff. And again, it'll be something that the community will see, you know, the fan base will see. And I hope that they'll be really proud of the direction in which they're heading.
Sometimes when these opportunities come up, Sean, and you talked about preparing for the interview and talking to RC, and did you expect that a chance would come this quickly into your front office career? I mean, it kind of was your sense when you first interviewed, hey, somebody's called me to interview, I'll just go up and go through the process. Was that your thinking at first, like thinking, am I that close to being a GM already?
Look, it's always been a goal as soon as I started the front offices. That's where I wanted to end up. Obviously, I'm very, very fortunate to have that opportunity now, and I look at it in this market and with this team. Now, there's only 30 of these jobs, and, you know, there's only a handful that are in the market and the place that Brooklyn is. And so I think I viewed it as a special job. I viewed it as, yes, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. There's absolutely a challenge ahead. There's no question of that. I think everybody realizes that. But with the changing of the CBA and the new money coming in and so forth, I think that gives Brooklyn, just like every other team, a chance, not a reset button, but in a weird way, you do get the luxury of somewhat starting over. I did not realize it would happen maybe this quickly. Mm-hmm. But like anything, I'm not going to just go through the process. If I'm going to go after it, you know, I'm going after try and win that. And I told RC when I was coming up here to interview, obviously with he and Pop's blessing, I said, look, I'm going after to get this thing. It's not just the process. I that doesn't mean no good. I mean, if I'm just going after the process, I'd much rather just stay here and continue to learn from you and Pop and be part of another championship run. So that was my mindset.
And along the